Well, thank you, Professor Purvis. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm after this problem-solving operation. I shall try then to present the points of view on equality of educational opportunity that I had dreamt up. When I was pondering upon it this afternoon, it occurred to me that a proper way of dealing with the problem of equality would be to quote our friend George Orwell. Some of you who have read his Animal Farm might remember that he says that human beings are created equal, and some are more equal than others. And I don't know to what extent this can be a motto on my presentation tonight. Anyhow, equality has in recent years become one of the keywords in the policy debate on educational problems, both at the national and international level. But equality of educational opportunity has not always been conceived of as a goal in itself, but as a means in the long-range perspective to bring about social equality. And I think this is a key question. Now, the first large-scale attempt to elucidate empirically to what extent equality has or has not been achieved in a particular national education system was presented in this country in the so-called Kuhlman Report. This survey, as you might recall, was initiated by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in accordance with which the U.S. Commissioner of Education was requested to conduct a survey, quote, concerning the lack of availability of equal educational opportunities for individuals by reason of race, color, religion, or national origin in public educational institutions at all levels in the United States, end quote. This survey set out mainly to elucidate the problem of to what extent, quote, the schools offer equal educational opportunities in terms of other criteria other than segregation, which are regarded as good indicators of educational quality, end quote. Now, some of these criteria were more tangible, such as libraries, textbooks, laboratories, and the like. Others were less tangible, such as curriculum offerings, grouping practices, and methods of instruction. And some, finally, were rather elusive, such as teacher competence and teacher attitudes. Now, when analyzing the concept of equality of educational opportunity, the crucial point, seems to me, is what should be meant by opportunity. I shall, in this context, chiefly confine my remarks to discussing this aspect of the concept. Now, from the point of view of the individual, equality of opportunity can be conceived of in three ways. One, as a starting point. Two, as a treatment. And three, as a final goal, or as a combination of all these three. We can think of equality as a state when all individuals start their educational career, at least their formal school career, on equal footing. From the genetic point of view, evidently they do not. But we can at least theoretically think of a state of affairs when all children are given exactly the same living conditions from the day of their birth. The difficult aspect of this is, of course, that they emanate from parents equipped genetically different, and therefore from the outset are subjected to different treatments, because genetic differences are to some extent correlated with variations in treatments. Now, secondly, equality can be thought of as applied to treatment. Everybody, irrespective of his genetic equipment and social origin, could be thought to be treated equally. In the first place, everybody could be equal before law and regulations. The welfare policy could be framed to guarantee everybody a minimum income or subsistence allowance. A kind of unitary system of preschool or regular school education could take care of all the children alike. Evidently, and this is a common experience both in capitalist and socialist economies, such a system does not necessarily lead to a complete and not even to an increased equalization among adults. When Premier Khrushchev introduced the Education Act of 1958 to the Supreme Soviet, he pointed out that the institutions of higher learning in Moscow, the majority of the students came from families belonging to the functionaries and the intelligentsia, as he put it. Only 30 to 40% came from families where the parents were peasants or working class, manual working class. Now, welfare policy, including, among other things, child allowances and the introduction of a unitary basic school and a system of upper and post-secondary education in Sweden with a student aid and tuition-free system, has by no means in our country leveled out the differences between working class and middle-upper class children in educational participation. I have mentioned these two illustrations to amplify the point that I made on equality of treatment. Now, thirdly and finally, equality of educational opportunity could be regarded as a goal or a set of guideposts in the sense that framing and implementation of educational policy should introduce measures that will contribute to an increased equalization in educational participation, and even more so in educational achievement. This, in its turn, will lead to a greater socioeconomic equalization in terms of economic status, participation in decision-making processes that concerns all the citizens, and so on. In an article that spells out some of the implications of his big survey, Jim Coleman raises the question whether equality means that one wants to have equal schools, that is, equal treatments, or whether one wants to have equal students. He points out that his survey had focused mainly on what comes out of education in terms of student achievement in areas such as reading and arithmetic, skills that are important for success not only in further schooling but also on the labor market. This, of course, does not permit any absolute judgment about the levels of equality or inequality of the schools that the students are attending, because the major portion of individual differences in achievements in fact, to a larger extent, accounted for by his home and peer environment than by the school. However, what matters to the student is not how equal his school is, but rather whether he is equipped at the end of the school to compete on an equal basis with others, whatever his social origin. I.e., then, in Coleman's judgment, the final aim should be that equality should pertain to the goal. Schools, and I quote Coleman, are successful only insofar as they reduce the dependence of a child's opportunity upon his social origin. Thus, equality of educational opportunity implies not merely equal schools, but equally effective schools whose influences will overcome the differences in starting point of the children from different social groups. And this implies not equal, but differential pedagogical treatment. I think I shouldn't take up time here by trying to refer to another paper 2 years later, where this was in Harvard Educational Review, when Professor Coleman set forth a very lucid analysis of how he looked at the concept of equality of educational opportunity. I think I should mention one or two things that he sets out, he spells out there. He distinguishes four stages in the development of the concept, and I think I should give this as a kind of background to my own attempt to analyze the concept. He says that in the pre-industrial society, with its extended family and patriarchal kinship system, and the family as the unit of production and as the center of social welfare, responsibility for social welfare and responsibility, education had no relevance at all. Geographical, occupational, and social mobility were minimal. The next stage then occurred when the Industrial Revolution changed the role of the family. The family was not longer a self-perpetuating economic unit or a training ground. The children became occupationally mobile outside the family. Training and social welfare became community responsibilities. Certain institutions were needed where the families could, where the children could learn skills that made them marketable outside the family. Elementary, tax-supported, and compulsory schooling was not universal in a strict sense, since it was only intended for the great masses, whereas the upper class already had a system of preparatory schools, schools that prepared them for the secondary academic education and for the universities, which in their turn then prepared for upper class occupations. Thus, the dual class stratified system in Europe during the 19th century emerged. The third stage is this. Both liberals and socialists in Europe for a long time conceived of equality of opportunity as being equality of exposure to a given curriculum. It was up to the child and his family to take advantage of the exposure offered. If he failed, he was himself to be blamed. Thus, the important thing from the point of view of policy making was to construct the system in such a way that all children, irrespective of social background, could be offered formal equality in terms of equal and free access to education. The liberal conception accepted a child's future as given. The problem of assigning children to different programs in a comprehensive system is to find programs that will, as it's often put, suit the individual needs of each child. But the problem is that what is taken for given is the problem. No guidance program based on the most elaborate system of testing can predict what will, quote, suit, end quote, a child in terms of his educational or occupational career. When one begins to realize that the essence of the problem is not the starting point, but the effects of education, the effects of schooling, one also begins to reformulate the problems in terms of how to bring about more equality of performance. The core of the problem then is whether equality is seen as a starting point or a goal, as I was pointing out a few minutes ago. Now, before I enter upon an attempt to spell out some of my own thinking on this problem, I think I should also point out to you some of the incompatibilities when we are discussing equalization in education. I think it's evident from what I have so far said that there are certain contradictory objectives or incompatibilities in the way equality of educational opportunity has been conceived. I already pointed out that the realization of a goal of equality is made difficult by the fact that human beings, from a genetic point of view, are born unequal, and that during the first years of their life, before then they enter upon regular institutionalized schooling, they are brought up by parents who differ not only with regard to their hereditary equipment, but also with regard to their social conditions. It should be emphasized in this connection that there is a tendency, in my view, among psychologists with a hereditarian view to generalize from findings which apply to somatic traits and generalize from that to psychological traits, i.e. then to behavior. But such an approach is hardly justified. Some of them have heavily drawn upon findings from genetic studies of, for instance, standing height and blood types and the like. It is one thing to try to calculate the heritability of traits such as height and weight that are directly accessible to observation and measurement, but quite another to determine for cognitive or other traits that these traits that have been inferred from observed behavior. I shall not here deal with the heredity environment controversy as far as scholastic ability is concerned. I think it's sufficient to point out here that there are indications that the heritability of the cognitive traits account for at most half the variance of scholastic attainments, but even this might be a gross overestimation, particularly since the conclusions on this point are drawn from twin studies where there are certain methodological problems that have been overlooked. But as I said, I wouldn't go into this now. Just suffice to make this this statement. Now, the incompatibility between equality and inherited differences, be they mainly genetic or environmental, gives rise to the question to what extent equality means identity of treatment. Does it mean that the treatment should be identical, or be so geared that optimal conditions are provided for each child to develop to the limits of his capacity? I have in another connection pointed out that the issue can be stated in a paradoxical way, namely that every child should have an equal opportunity to be treated unequally. Such a philosophy is behind some of the efforts that we have been noticing in recent years of individualized instruction. And those of you who are familiar, for instance, with the philosophy of mastery learning also note that this philosophy is behind that type of teaching learning strategy. The implementation of such a philosophy, however, aims at attaining greater equality of education and achievement, and is by no means then conducive to increased variability. One couldn't proceed and state another paradox that is a corollary to the first one. The very fact that children from the outset are unequal enables a democratic society to give them equal opportunity to be treated differently without incurring the risk of fully equalized society. Had they all from the beginning been genetically equal, there would have been ample reason to treat them differently in order to bring about a variation without which the world would have been unbearable. One geneticist, I'm referring to Dobzhansky, raises the question whether attempts to bring about equalization in terms of treatment, particularly in the educational system, will lead to a wider or a more narrow variability in, for instance, scholastic performance. If measures are taken to remove environmental barriers that prevent the development of scholastic ability, could we then expect a shrinking variability of scholastic achievements? This is an interesting question. According to the simple model, a simple mathematical model that implies that observed variance is the sum of genetic and environmental variance, the answer to the question would be yes. I.e. then it would be shrinking, the variability. But if environment and heredity are closely correlated, the answer is most likely no. Thus, the full utilization and promotion of talent by removing discriminatory barriers could in this case lead to a meritocratic society. instead of having a society built on social and birth prerogatives, we would get one built on genetic prerogatives, particularly if educated ability is such a status-determining factor as it tends to be in present-day society. Now, another incompatibility is inherent in our present highly complex industrialized society. John Locke's and Jean-Jacques Rousseau's ideas about the origin of inequalities. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote a treatise in 1754, an essay sur inégalité parmi les hommes. His essay from 1754, I think, in a way, is embodied in the American Declaration of Independence, that all human beings are born equal. But their ideas is running counter to the demands emanating from the modern, highly specialized and complex society with a wide range of differentiated roles. There is a problem here, then. One is entitled to raise the question, to what extent the dynamics behind the social fabric in our kind of society is conducive to promoting intellectual and social differences. We do not have empirical data by means of which comparisons could be carried out between various stages in the development of, for example, the European societies since the beginning of the 18th century. There are, however, indications that the variability in terms of such cognitive differences as account for a major portion of scholastic attainments covered then a much wider range than now. In the first place, formal schooling was the prerogative at that time of only a small segment of the population, and it would therefore seem pointless to make comparisons between then and now in terms of scholastic achievements. It would seem to make much more sense to compare two stages fairly close to each other in time in our own societies. It would be of considerable interest to compare the educational systems in Europe about 1900 with the systems that are now prevailing and make that comparison in terms of variability of attainments. More than 50 years ago, all the educational systems in Europe were more or less dual track systems with one elementary school of rather poor quality for the masses and an academic university preparing secondary school for the social elite. For a long time, these two systems were completely separate. That is to say, access to secondary education was mainly gained by attending private preparatory schools. The core problem that ought to be elucidated by such a comparison would be if and how variability in scholastic attainment is affected by setting up of a single-track system during compulsory school age. There are indications that seem to show that structural changes in the systems have narrowed down the range, as I hinted at a minute ago. When comparisons were made between comprehensive systems on the one hand and selective or dualistic on the other in the International Project for the Evaluation of Educational Achievement, we found that by and large the comprehensive systems tended to show a lower spread of student performance, contrary to the expectations. One could, of course, question whether the introduction of a single-track unitary system is an outcome of greater homogeneity in society brought about by social changes, or to what extent it has been conducive to such a homogeneity. What is cause and what is effect in this case? Surveys carried out in Sweden seem to indicate that the structural changes of this kind are to some extent instrumental in narrowing down to some extent the disparity in educational participation between various socioeconomic groups. Let me now, ladies and gentlemen, for the rest of my presentation, try to spell out how I view the change of the conception of equality of education and opportunity, where I think one could distinguish between three major stages in the development of the concept of educational opportunity, corresponding then these three stages to three more or less distinct social philosophies. And let me begin with what I would like to call the conservative conception of equality of educational opportunity. This conception was prevalent in most industrialized countries until World War I. God has bestowed different amounts of capacity upon each human being, and it was up to the individual to make the best possible use of that capacity. A more conservative variant of this philosophy maintained that by and large, God has given each individual the aptitudes that correspond to the social class or the caste in which he was born. And a very interesting coincidence. The more or less tacit assumption was then that the individual had not only to make optimal use of his capacity, but to be content with it, because he had been given what he by birth deserved. Now, a more liberal variant of this philosophy that can be traced from the Renaissance through the 18th century, particularly during the age of the mercantile era, with its emphasis on what in Latin was called selectio ingeniorum, selection of talent, they advanced the idea that it was important to search for the scarce gold of talent among the masses in order to take, for the sake of the nation's economy, to take benefit of this, and also, in some cases, to the fame of the selected individual. Now, the political implications of this philosophy are interesting to follow in Europe from the end of the 19th century, when the changing industrialization led to the demands for new types of schools. I think a case in point is my own country during the 1880s, when there was a kind of rapid industrialization. This rapid industrialization initiated a demand for adequately trained white-collar workers, particularly clerks, while some self-employed persons who are running small enterprises also needed more advanced skills than those provided in the rather low-quality elementary school. On the other side, there was at that time the elementary school, I should perhaps insert here, the elementary school, which had been made compulsory in the beginning of the 1840s, provided a, as I said, a rather insufficient preparation for the new class of clerks and for the kind of labor that the expanding industry and commerce needed. Now, on the other side, there was at that time the classical gymnasium, which by and large had not changed since the middle of the 17th century and prepared students for university with a curriculum that leaned heavily towards Latin and humanistic studies in general. The conservative view in the debate that began in the 1880s was advanced in a brochure by a secondary school head teacher, Frederick Anderson. He contended that the gymnasium suited the needs of those who are heading for upper class positions, and that the elementary school catered to those who belong to the mass of manual workers in rural or urban areas. What was needed was a school that could cater to the needs of the new middle class of clerks and small entrepreneurs. He therefore outlined a middle school to which students should be allowed to transfer also from the public elementary school, and from which they could graduate at the age of 16 or 17, that is, 2 or 3 years earlier than those who graduated from the upper secondary classical school. The legislation enacted by the Swedish parliament in 1904 divided the gymnasium then in two stages and postponed the introduction of Latin in order to give room for a less humanistic curriculum during the lower stage of the secondary school. I think it should in this connection also be pointed out that transfer from the public elementary school to the academic secondary school in our country was not possible until 1894. Before then, the students had to go through private preparatory schools. Now, a faint reminder of the conservative philosophy I found as late as in 1959, a report of the Commission on Education, a German Commission of Education, that was appointed in 1950s, at the beginning of the 50s, by the Permanent Conference of the German Ministers of Education, in order to draw up guidelines for the further development of the school system in the Federal Republic. In this report, a common structural framework, a so-called Rahmenplan, was developed. The elementary school, the Volksschule, the middle school, the Mittelschule, and the Höhere Schule, the Gymnasium, were to some extent thought of to serve the needs of three different social classes. Now, I give the Swedish and German examples, but they apply to all Western, highly industrialized countries, at least the European ones. The creation of a short non-university preparing general secondary school has in most cases been explicitly based on the argument of the need for middle-level manpower. Two so-called black papers, which were published in England in 1970, a group of authors attacked the reform of British education, particularly the attempts to abolish streaming and to abolish the 11 plus examinations and the attempts to introduce comprehensive secondary education. It is contended in these black papers that recent changes have brought about a marked decline in educational standards and that this threat to the quality of education has been launched by, quote, an ideology of egalitarianism, end quote. In the first of these papers, in an article under the title The Egalitarian Threat, the author tries to make a distinction between equality of educational opportunity and egalitarianism. He says that the egalitarian wants all children to have equal opportunity to obtain a good education, but the egalitarian philanthropist is letting his emotions carry him away. And I quote, in the name of fairness and social justice, sentimentality has gone far to weaken the essential toughness on which the quality of British education depends, end quote. The egalitarian instinctively dislikes any process which enables some children to emerge markedly ahead of their fellows, end quote. He therefore attempts to, attempts to destroy the schools which are taking care of the best talented students. All kinds of education are not, as far as the egalitarians pretend, of equal worth and importance. Nor can anything but harm come of claiming equal status for all kinds of educational institutions, end quote. Equality of opportunity is named a worthy ideal, which, however, cannot be achieved quickly if one wants to avoid to, quote, damage the total quality of our society, end quote. In the introduction to Black Paper 2, which turned out in the same year, the editors are saying that one can have either equality or equality of opportunity, and that one cannot have them both. In fact, the attempts to bring about equality are inimical to the attempts to achieve equality of educational opportunity. And in the same publication, they make the case that a comprehensive system that treats every student equally in terms of formal availability of education creates even greater inequality than the present British elitist system. What should be achieved is to provide, the authors go on to say, is to provide every child with the best possible chance to develop his particular talents in an optimal way. Quote, this can be accomplished only by an unequal, differentiated educational system which levels out the handicap for the able pupil by the inadequacies of his family's social and economic position, end quote. The British grammar school has provided countless gifted working class children with the opportunity to break down the class barriers and achieve unrestricted scope for their talents, end quote. The next stage, I would say, of the next type of philosophy, and this also represents the next stage in the development, is what I already referred to as the liberal conception of equality of educational opportunity. And this, I think, is the still prevailing philosophy in the development of the concept of equality of opportunity. As a case of point, I could cite one of the debaters in the 1880s in Sweden, Fritjof Berg, who was an elementary school teacher and later a member of the Swedish parliament and for two periods at the beginning of the century Minister of Education. He challenged the conservative view, and he was, as a matter of fact, rebutting Mr. Anderson, who earlier in his brochure had advanced the conservative philosophy. He challenged the conservative view that power and capacity has accrued to one particular social class, and Berg strongly advocated the elementary school as a single-track school that would encompass children from all social classes. After the completion of the 6 years, which was at that time the compulsory period, they could then pursue different types of education, be they practical or theoretical, depending upon the individual bents. Somewhat schematically, this classical liberal philosophy could be described then as follows. Each individual is born with a certain, relatively constant capacity or intelligence. The educational system should be so designed as to remove external barriers of an economic and or geographical nature that prevent able students from lower classes to take advantage of the intelligence that they have been born with and which entitles them to due social promotion. To quote one person who was strongly influenced by Berg, Count Rudenfeld, in his book on thoughts concerning social mobility of 1854, he developed a blueprint for a school system, utopian school system at that time in Sweden, that should promote the maximum of social mobility in not only seeing to it that able young people from lower classes were duly promoted, but that upper class youngsters with limited capacities should be given humble schooling and channeled into the humble manual occupations as well. Now, everybody then, according to Rudenfeld, via his education, should be given the social status to which he was entitled by his inherited aptitudes. Now, many structural reforms of the school systems in Europe during this century has at least partly been guided by this philosophy, by extending education to more advanced levels, by making the compulsory part of it less differentiated or more single-tracked, and by making it available to children from all walks of life. One can remove the handicaps that are inherent in being born poor or living geographically far from school. Now, the 1944 Education Act in England, which made secondary school universal and available not only to those who could afford it, was regarded by many as a democratic breakthrough. But about 10 years later, when a survey was carried out to elucidate its effect on the social structure of the enrollment to the academic secondary school, it was found that at least in certain regions, the proportion of working class children admitted to grammar school was lower than before the democratic breakthrough. When the economic barriers were removed and all the places were thrown open for competition within the framework of the 11 plus examination system, children from the middle and lower middle class homes were in much better positions to compete for these places than those from less privileged backgrounds, and therefore achieved an increased representation, whereas earlier certain number of places were set aside for working class kids, irrespective of the relative position at the entry to this type of school. So previously a certain quota of places had been set, had been available for those of poor background. Now these studies, and there were several of them in England, clearly demonstrated that selectivity in an educational system does not go together with parity of participation. A certain amount of social bias is always connected with a selective educational system, i.e. an elitism on a pure abstract intellectual basis is not able, that you can't achieve. You achieve at the same time selectivity in terms of social background. Now, the transition from an ascriptive feudal society where more advanced formal education was a prerogative for those who by birth, wealth, and connections were designated for upper class positions, to a society in which access to and promotion and reward within the educational system depended upon tested ability was regarded as a tremendous progress by means of which justice and efficiency alike was expected to be achieved. In attempting to, quote, democratize education, objectively assessed academic ability, be it so-called intelligence tests, achievement tests, examination grades, or any other objective indicator of accomplishment, seemed to be the self-evident selection criterion to replace social class, economic background, and personal connections. In analyzing the educational system in industrialized and technological societies, particularly in Europe, for example, the French sociologist Bourdieu contends that there are indications of the educational system tending to assume the function of reproduction, that is to say, to preserve or even reinforce existing structure of the society instead of being an agent of social mobility according to inherited ability and the motivation to use it. Now, recent surveys of existing research of participation rates and school achievements as related to social background by, for instance, OECD in Paris, and quite a lot of these documents were prepared for their policy conference in 1970, provide fairly consistent evidence that the extended provisions for education and thereby increased formal accessibility to free secondary and higher education for all children of a given age has not considerably changed the social structure of the enrollment. Students who take advantage of the increased opportunities are already in a favored or a semi-favored position. The same holds true for adults. Legislation enacted in Sweden in 1966 made the upper secondary education, i.e. the education that qualified for university entrance, available to adults free of charge in the late afternoon or evening classes, which was an terribly expensive program. Now, surveys conducted to reveal the nature of the enrollment have consistently shown that those who have taken advantage of the new opportunities are to a large extent youngish people on, so to speak, the launching pad at the foot of the promotion ladder who have already received a certain amount of formal education. Participation by individuals who fall within the category of unskilled workers is minimal. What has been demonstrated by drawing upon survey data could just as well be brought out by scrutinizing the logic behind the liberal philosophy, according to which admission and promotion in the educational system should be guided by individual capacity or aptitude and not by socioeconomic background. The specific criteria of, quote, capacity are by and large either grades, school marks, scores on objective tests, and examination results. All these criteria are correlated with social background. Thus, socioeconomic status indices, which measure either status ratings, upper, middle, or lower class, or certain economic factors such as income and size of family tend to correlate between 0.2 and 0.4 with test scores and school achievements. When, however, one takes into consideration the major psychological aspects of the environment in which the child is brought up, for example, the interaction between mother and child, the kind of independence training, the parental support, and the extent to which emulation of relevant parental behavior is possible and, which is important, rewarded, one finds substantially higher correlations. Some studies have found correlations which run as high as 0.7 or 0.8 between certain environmental process variables in the home on one hand and intelligence test scores and standardized achievements tests on the other. Therefore, access to and promotion in accordance with objectively assessed capacity within the educational system by no means exclude the influence of socioeconomic factors, which, according to the liberal philosophy, are discarded by employing criteria of academic merit. As long as admission to a certain type of education is generous in terms of the proportion admitted from those who apply, and the attrition rate during a given stage is low, and as long as education is available to all free of charge, socioeconomic background plays, of course, a less prominent role. But as soon as competitive selection takes place, either at admission or in terms of grade repeating and dropout during the course, then the correlation between background and indicators of performance increases considerably. A case of point is the selection for the Faculty of Medicine in Sweden, which, as with all lines of study with restricted admission, is carried out on the basis of marks obtained in the gymnasium, with the possible exception of the intake to the training program for psychologists. There is no other program that is so highly selective. Also, there is no other faculty with such a grossly imbalanced representation of social classes as in the Faculty of Medicine. I think I should, in this context, as a kind of footnote, refer to an article in the Saturday Review entitled End of the Impossible Dream by Peter Schrag in 1970. He points out that the establishment of a common school has been part of the American dream, that the schools held the promise of providing equality of educational opportunity, and that they were expected to guarantee an open society unafflicted by social and economic inequalities. Horace Mann, in the middle of the last century, foresaw that the school for children from all walks of life would be, quote, a greater equalizer of the conditions of men, the balance wheel of the social machinery. It does better than disarm the poor of their hostility towards the rich. It prevents being poor, end quote. Now, apart from being an equalizer, the educational system was seen as a prime instrument for the individual born under humble circumstances to join the certified and school meritocracy. Everybody should be given equal opportunity to achieve and to be promoted, provided he had the aptitude and the energy to go ahead. It has not until very recently, by the social scientists, in the first place, been realized that these two objectives, as they are commonly conceived, are in fact not compatible. The school cannot at the same time serve as an equalizer and as an instrument that establishes, reinforces, and legitimizes distinctions. This has been particularly highlighted by recent surveys that have tried to account for children's differences in school achievements. Their social and economic background and that of their peers account for more of the differences in the accomplishments than the school resources together. This is evident from the Coleman survey, from the Plowden study in England, and from the international evaluation study. In a way, one can say that for a long time, equality of educational opportunity has been interpreted in terms of social Darwinism. Everybody in the jungle was to be treated equally. one standard, one set of books, one fiscal formula for children everywhere, regardless of race, creed, and color. Success went to the resourceful, to the ambitious, to the bright, to the strong. Those who failed were stupid or shiftless, but whatever the reason, failure was the responsibility of the individual, or perhaps of his parents, poor fellow, but certainly not of the school or of the society. Now, as long as we are employing one uniform, relative linear standard, bright, average, slow learner, or whatever labels we want to use, some students are, by definition, of course, destined to fail. In his writing about mastery learning, Professor Benjamin Bloom has been questioning the whole conception of individual differences in student achievement that has been regarded as an axiomatic foundation of what has been going on in the schools, particularly during the last century, when education in developed countries has become universally available. Students are continuously judging their performances against the standards set by their teachers, peers, and parents. But those standards vary, so that a student who belongs to the bottom group in a school with very high standards perceive himself as a failure, even if his attainments measured against some kind of national standard are far above the average. Conversely, a student with the same objective level of attainment perceives himself as a success in a school with a low standard. And Bloom points out that these perceptions very strongly influence student interest, attitudes, and motivations, which in their turn contribute to widen and reinforce individual differences in attainment. This is one major explanation for the fact that variability in attainments, for instance in reading, increases by grades in most industrialized countries. One of the major points in the strategy which goes under the name of mastery learning is to set an absolute goal in such a way that with appropriate methods of instruction it can be reached by the majority of students. Now, the rethinking about individual differences that has been going on in recent years has important practical implications. According to the social Darwinism view, equality had to do only with what goes on into the system, so its input resources. The question is now asked if one should not also consider what comes out of the system and thereby waive the equality at the input side by providing extra resources for those who are regarded as socially and or culturally deprived. This was, for instance, the philosophy behind the Head Start program, whatever its merits or failures. Kuhlmann pointed out that, quote, equality of educational opportunity implies not only equal schools, but equally effective schools whose influences will overcome the differences in starting point of children from different social groups, end quote. Now, educational deprivation is usually defined in terms of one particular set of values, namely the extent to which the social and economic conditions under which a child is brought up are conducive to success in the regular school. Other values enhance cultural distinctions, which in our pluralistic society have also been taken into account by the educational system. Dobzhansky, the geneticist, has concerned himself with what he calls the, quote, confusion of political and sociological genetics, end quote. He states the problem of equal opportunity in a rather paradoxical way. Quote, because human beings are individuals and not types, because they are all different, equality of opportunity is necessary, end quote. But equality of opportunity does not imply identity of treatment, as I have repeatedly pointed out. The genetic diversity of the human species enhances its adaptability. And in order to facilitate adaptability, one would have to see to it that every individual is given equal opportunity to achieve the realization of his own particular potentialities. The practical implications in terms of policy that ensues from the rethinking of the concept of equal opportunity is that it is not very fruitful to put the responsibility for scholastic success or failure upon the individual, One has to shift the burden of responsibility to the system, to the educational system, or to society at large. In the long run, then, it seems that the problem of achieving equality of opportunity is one of restoring multiple options based on different values, but values that are not ranked along only one dimension. By definition, no society with but one avenue of approved entry into the mainstream of dignity can be fully open. When that single instrument of entry is charged with selecting people out, and where there are no honorable alternatives for those who are selected out, we are promising to all men things that we cannot deliver. No wonder, then, that we are beginning to amass so much evidence for a uniform provision within the educational system not being the solution to a more, quote, equal society. Or to paraphrase Orwell, those who are at the outset are more equal than others will take more advantage. That is the lesson learned from the equalization program under the liberal philosophy at all levels of education. Now, let me finish by trying to bring together in a very rhapsodic way some of my thinking on a new conception of equality of educational opportunity. Now, the removal of economic and social barriers, which according to the liberal philosophy would open the gates to more advanced education for all those whose natural aptitudes qualify them, and apparently didn't suffice. Inequalities in a highly selective and competitive system do in fact remain, or even tend to increase. This is beyond any doubt if we study the development, particularly in certain European systems. The difference between comprehensive system with a single-track basic school covering the compulsory school age and those systems with a dual-track structure where selection in one way or another actually takes place or is prepared earlier, this is the difference between them is just a difference in degree. And it doesn't suffice. Comprehensiveness doesn't suffice. A case in point here is, for instance, Japan. But the decisive impetus to a new thinking in this area has come from the interest taken in recent years in preschool education. You all know that the discussion launched in the beginning of the 1960s with the discovery that quite a substantial part of the individual differences that you could find with children of the age of 15, 16 were accounted for already by difference which were there when they entered regular school. This meant then that if environmental influences were of a great importance in bringing about intellectual differentiation, one had to look at the period before the elementary school stage. It therefore seemed doubtful if the school could act as a prime equalizer. And this role of being an equalizer, one thought then, should be adopted rather by the preschool institutions, to which then children of that age all should have access. A new area of research on early experience and the socialization of cognitive modes in children by means of communication and language has been opened up by Basil Bernstein in England. He has elucidated how language competence can act as a barrier or promoter in getting along in primary school. Similar studies have been conducted by Overman in Germany. Furthermore, studies of the effect of environment on school motivation provided another impetus that focused interest on the preschool years. Thus, equality of educational opportunity cannot be achieved simply by removing certain material barriers and by using academic ability as the democratizing criterion. The more competitive the educational system is, and the more essential formal education becomes for occupational promotion or social mobility, the more likely it is that the social disparities will prevail. In view of this evidence, which I cannot deal with more in this context, we are forced to revise the liberal conception that so far has been prevalent among educators and policymakers who have been concerned about the inequalities and want to rectify the present situation. As I pointed out earlier, the basic idea behind the reforms launched to achieve more equality of opportunity or more equality in participation have aimed at removing external barriers of an economic and or geographical nature. The hope being then that every individual would then have an opportunity to educate his nature-given intelligence and thereby reach the positions in society to which his primary talent entitled him. The experience gained from research, particularly research on preschool education in recent years, has been conducive to a more radical conception of equality of educational opportunity. It does not suffice to establish formal equality of access to education. One also has to provide greater equality in the preschool institutions or in the regular school for children of various social background to acquire intelligence. As far as IQ differentiation is concerned, the major portion of it has occurred, as I pointed out a minute ago, before the child has entered regular school. The family, and not least the peer culture, still exerts a strong influence. Thus, in order to achieve greater equality in school achievements, society would have to adopt special means to compensate for the deficiencies of the environment in which a child grows up, or to supplement what may have been done at the home or may not have been done at the home. In the case of families that prove indifferent or even antagonistic to the measures society contemplates, it might even be necessary to take action against them, their will, if the equality objective is to be pursued. Now, the basic difference between the two conceptions, on the one hand, what I somewhat schematically has called the liberal, and on the other hand, the, let's call it the sociological, is, as I already indicated, how they view the role of the educational system. According to the former conception, which holds that the task is primarily to remove external barriers so as to make the original capacity in each child develop, success and failure in school primarily depends upon the individual student. Once the avenues have been opened up for free competition, his nature-given intellectual and moral resources are the decisive factors. If he fails, he has to cast the blame upon himself because he has been given the opportunity and not taking proper advantage of it. According to the other conception, student success, and not least student failure, has to be ascribed mainly to the system, particularly to the way instruction is organized. The basic problem then turns on to the extent to which the school has been able to provide the conditions conducive to satisfactory student development. On the part of the school, such a conception implies revision of basic pedagogical notions. The common denominator for any action that would have to be taken is, as I see it, individualization of the entire system of instruction. From this it follows then that equality of opportunity, as I also pointed out, does not mean identity of opportunity, and herein lies the fundamental problem in modern democracy. According to the philosophy that I have spelled out above, equality of opportunity means that every child should be given optimal opportunity to develop his particular personal assets as they are at the time educational treatment in a public institution begins. The objective cannot reasonably be to establish equality in the sense that all children are treated in exactly the same way. The issue could be put in a paradoxical way by saying that one should provide, as I said, equal opportunity for unequal treatment, so far as socially relevant differences are concerned. Finally then, ladies and gentlemen, the new conception that I have been trying to spell out here of equality of educational opportunity is that in order to achieve the long-range objective of more equality in occupational career and standards of living, remedial action must be taken in the wider context in which schools are operating, that is, society at large. Education reform cannot serve as a substitute for social reforms, but this is another story. Thank you.